Good evening and welcome to WILL's second community cinema screening and discussion. I'm Kimberly Cronick. I'm Director of Community Engagement at Illinois Public Media. And all across the country, people in communities, 100 of them in fact, are coming together to watch and discuss tonight's film, Me Facing Life's Centoya Story, about families, the juvenile justice system, sexual abuse, and murder. Public television is known for our high-quality independent documentaries, and tonight we hope we'll start to earn a reputation for bringing community cinema into the community to watch and enjoy, but also engage in meaningful discussion about local connections to issues in the film. In order to do that, we've joined with organizations who have deep knowledge and connections with the film's topic. Tonight's community partners are the Access Initiative, a community movement to build a system of care for youth who have been impacted by the juvenile justice system or with social, emotional, and behavioral challenges. Also partnering with us is the Champaign County Mental Health Board and the Peer Ambassadors, who are a group of primarily African-American teens between 13 and 18 who are peer mentors and advocates in schools and in the community for youth involved in the juvenile justice system and the mental health system. And of course, we're grateful to our national partner, the Independent Television Service, who brings us this community cinema, which we air every week on Tuesday nights at 9. And we're going to show the film with closed captioning on, and our discussion will be signed for the hearing impaired. And our signer tonight is Stacey Leverich from the Office of Disability Resources and Educational Services, and we thank her for her service. Mike Pritchard is providing the audio. Our moderator for the discussion will be Jack Brighton. We do have surveys. We'd love for you to, at the end of the night, to tell us how we did and to give us your contact information so we can connect you with additional films. So please do fill that out. It's very important to us that we continue to improve on what we do. And the gentleman who put all of this together and who will be your host for tonight's discussion is WILL's outreach producer, Henry Radcliffe.
Good evening, everyone. Just like Kimberly said, I'd like to thank everyone for coming out and thank all of our partners. We've got sort of a tight time schedule, so I won't take too much of your time, and we will start the film shortly.
My name is Jack Brighton with Illinois Public Media. I'm here to host this panel discussion. I want to introduce our panelists in a second, and I also want to invite people in the audience to participate by asking questions or, you know, sharing your thoughts and feelings about this film. Our panelists up here are going to help provide some perspective and some local context to this film. Carol Bradford is Executive Director of the Lutheran Social Services and also an Access Initiative Coordinating Council member. Tracy Dace, right here, is a peer ambassador and also Shalonda Sales, next to him, peer ambassador. And we also have Chandra Somerville. She is with the Access Initiative as well. And maybe just to start with, I could ask each of you to say something about what you do, and starting with you, Chandra, about the Access Initiative.
Good evening. I'm Chandra Somerville, and I'm with the Access Initiative here in Champaign County. And the Access Initiative is building a system of care that is trauma and justice informed, and we're working cross-system, collaborating and communicating with system partners to make sure that youth and their families don't fall through the cracks. Centoya's story is an example of how a traumatic childhood, their environment, and decision-making can get you involved in the juvenile justice system. I currently serve as the Cultural Competence Coordinator with the Access Initiative. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Carol, would you please just give us a little bit about Lutheran Social Services and what you do?
I'm the Program Director at Lutheran Social Services of Illinois. I've been there just a little over a year, but I've worked in child welfare and mental health for the past 18 years. Most of my experience has been in residential treatment with children who look very similar to Centoya.
Okay, great. And Tracy and Shalonda, you're both peer ambassadors. Could you talk about what you do? Start with you, Shalonda.
I used to be a peer ambassador, former peer ambassador. I kind of feel like I used to be Centoya, not to that extent, but that's how I became a peer ambassador, because I started off just like her.
Wow, okay.
Good evening. My name is Tracy Dace. I'm the co-coordinator for the Peer Ambassador Program. And the Peer Ambassador is a youth advocacy and leadership program for youth who have been involved or impacted by the juvenile justice, the mental health, or the child welfare systems. And those youth who are in peer ambassadors are advocates, they're peer counselors, and they are charged with making a difference in our community.
Thank you. I want to start some of the basic questions for our panel, but I want to invite you to ask your own questions. There is a microphone that is available, and if you would like to speak, ask a question to the panel, et cetera, we would ask that you use the microphone, raise your hand to get access to it, because we are recording this this conversation. We'd like to have a record of it so that other people could benefit from it as well, and that would help everybody hear you also. So if you'd like to, just raise your hand, and Henry will pass it around. Let me start, and I want to ask Tracy and Shalonda just to start, what is it you mentioned, Shalonda, you said that, you could have been Centoya. I mean, is she, she's portrayed, and she's very intelligent, obviously, very, very charming, attractive, articulate young woman. Is she an average person? I mean, what do you think about, how she's portrayed in this? Do you get a sense that she is like a normal teenager?
If you're saying average in a way as, like just on a average person, then okay, no, she's not average. But nowadays, looking at our us, the teens are now, yeah, she's average. That's what, that's what we're looking like. They're dysfunctional, their parents not paying attention. What can I say? I mean, it's just like a lot of them is letting them slip through the cracks. Mm-hmm. A lot of parents and programs and, So if we're saying average as in, average just how we grow as, normal people, I would say no. But if we're saying just average in our today life and, the last couple of years, yes, she is. She is average.
How many other kids in our community would you say are subject to the types of experiences depicted by Centoya's story?
I can't even give you a number
because
it's a lot. And I'm steady seeing more and more of it, JDC, DCFS. I mean, it's just, I can't even give you a number, but it's really become our average as being a dysfunctional thing because of, the things your family been through, the way you was raised, or even just being in a system, being placed in the wrong place and the family not understanding you. And, not knowing where you come from, your background, things like that.
Tracy, would you agree with that? What do you think?
I would agree. There is definitely a disproportionate number of youth in our community who are involved in these systems. And I would also say that we need to stop thinking of our youth as falling through the cracks. Our youth are in the cracks. And we need to really address the issues that's going on in our community, because it's past due thinking of how do we look at them as being at risk. They are having very high risk factors. And this is my third time watching Centoya's story. And every time I watch it, I'm just reminded of the many, many youth, young people, young men, young women in this community that I can just look at her story, but I'm seeing a different face or a different name or a different experience. And it's just time for action for us to really begin to address what's going on. And her story is a very powerful story. And I think that we need to definitely show it to other people so that we can come together as a community to understand the issues of youth who have disabilities, who are suspected of having disabilities, and who are just in crisis in our community.
Carol, let me ask you. I think the statement was the kids are—they're falling through the cracks, but they're in the cracks. What do we do about that? How do we begin to address recognition of the situation that these kids are in?
That's a million-dollar question, and if I had the answer, I would be rich. and I was asked to represent child welfare and mental health. And I think the first thing is to acknowledge that there is a problem. And the second is to realize that we are all to blame. And I believe the third is to put aside, and I'm only talking to the adults in the room, to put aside our differences, because those of us in the social services community, we all, I believe, have the same goal. We want to help children. We want to help families. But because we come from different perspectives and different points of view, oftentimes there's been a clash on how to do that and how to make it work. There's lots of programs in this community. But when you look at the programs actually coordinating services and talking to each other and working together and being creative and being able to think outside the box and not just do what we've always done, what we've always done is not working. And so if we can just acknowledge that and then come together and try to actually come up with solutions and ask those that we're trying to help, how can we help? What can we do that we have not done? What do you need from us? Not us coming to the table being the expert, but allowing the children and the families to be the experts on themselves and to teach us and show us what they need and what they want from us. I think that's where we start.
I want to pick up on that thread real fast. You said that we need to come together and have conversations about this. And this seems to be, you know, maybe one of those places where we can begin that conversation. How can we continue it?
We have to continue it. We have to make the effort. Everybody's busy. We all have jobs and families and concerns, but it has to become a priority. And again, I think we have to take some of the obstacles that we've put in the way as providers, service providers, and push those out of the way. And like I said, you know, it's a million-dollar question. I don't have all the answers, but I can say in the time that I've been around, I've seen lots of different programs come and go. I've seen lots of different people come and go, but you still see the same issues and concerns with the children and adolescents and their families in the community. And we have to be open and honest, and we have to be willing to dialogue. And like I said, we have to set aside our differences as far as whatever our training and education or our perspective or even our own personal experiences and open ourselves up to allow people to show us and tell us what they need. Let them lead us instead of us trying to be the leaders all the time.
Go ahead.
I would also say that I think in light of the situations across the nation regarding our youth, it's time out for dialoguing. We know the issues and the concerns, and we just really need to move with deliberate speed. When the Supreme Court Justice decided on the Board of Education, Brown versus Board of Education, they said, we want to implement this with deliberate speed, meaning that we need to stop talking and we need to stop planning. Mm-hmm. We need to really come together and put down some action items so that we can begin to really address what we're doing. And that's the purpose of the Access Initiative. That's why we have something where we're trying to create this system of change in our community so that we can really support and help to change the systems to make a better outcomes for youth and families.
Who needs to be in that conversation? I mean, what can you do as Access Initiative to bring together the people that need to be at the table?
Who needs to be?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. Well, first of all, we need people who are the workers, and I think the workers, middle management, I think for the most part they're in it. I think it's the people who actually impact and affect policy that really needs to see and actually become and hear the voices who is actually being impacted. So it's all of those people working together, everyone working together. It's not just a bottom down or a bottom up approach. We're trying to meet in the middle somewhere. And so we have to meet in the middle to be able to talk about what is really impacting families and listening to them to say, how can we be served better and moving forward that way.
I want to add to that, too. I think that when you're working with children and families, you have to look at everything that's impacting them. And you have to look at child welfare. You have to look at mental health. You have to look at the educational system. You have to look at the community. You have to look within the family unit. All of those entities need to be at the table. And, you know, I do agree with Tracy. We've talked and talked until we're blue in the face. But again, because of some of those differences in how we want to approach the problem, we haven't been able to get to any action. And so it is my hope and my prayer that we will get to that point where there's some action. We have to, because we're losing our kids. And it's affecting all of us, even if it's not your child that's having the problem. Your child is going to school with a child who has the problem. Mm-hmm. They live in your neighborhood. They go to your church. So it's affecting everybody, yes.
I got to say, this is the second time I've seen the film, and it hit me much harder the second time. And I have a feeling that if I saw it a third time, it would be even more powerful. I'm wondering, you know, those of you who may have seen it for the first time, I'm guessing everybody in this room probably hasn't aired yet, but what was your reaction? If you have some thoughts, some questions for our panel, certainly invite you to share that.
Hi, my name is Viona Gross, and I'm with Access Initiative Youth Advisory Board. This is my first time actually seeing it, and I wanted to cry. I'm very emotional sometimes, but when it's about our youth and our community or around the nation, it's something that's my passion. That's why I do the work. And to see the different things that she went through from zero on up, she shouldn't have got what she got. It should have been, okay, serve some time. You committed a crime, you do some time, but not life. When she was in the system, if the system failed her, what is left? She don't got her mama. She got a foster parent. She not confident in that person. Maybe a little bit, but if it's not fully confident, it's not a real relationship, or if you don't have that one person you can go talk to about anything, I have that one person. And because of that one person, I am where I am today. I ain't gonna say her name. She's in the room, but because of her. If you have that one person in your life, or if that one person in this community especially, take the step and say, I want to make a difference in somebody's life. I want to be a mentor. I want to be somebody's coach, whatever you want to call it. That's all it takes. And build rapport, and that's what I got to say.
Thank you. That was wonderful. I mean, the question occurs to me, is it ever too late for a 16-year-old like Santoya? Do we give up on people, you know, who are in such circumstances? And it seems to be that, you know, in reality, we do. She's serving a life sentence. She won't have a life, you know, really. Is that really a decision that we made? Is that the right decision? It seems to be the reality. Anybody thoughts about that? Is it too late for someone in her situation?
It's never too late.
Never too late.
It's never too late. as I said before, you know, when I first started talking, you know, saying that was me. You know, I never murdered nobody, and never a lot of stuff, not to that extent. But you know, not trying to go back or sidetrack. But like I've heard, you know, a few other people stand up and say, that, you know, this is my first or third time seeing this film, and it was just so powerful to me, or, you know, it really touched me, or, you know, it hurt, or whatever the case may have been. I've watched this film also 3 times, and the first time it bothered me a little bit, just a little bit, but it didn't, because I'm looking at her, you know, and I'm not saying it me, you know what I'm saying, it impacted you watching this, you know what I'm saying, happen on the movie, but you're looking at her. When you out in the community and teens, and that's her. That's Santoya. She haven't murdered nobody, but that's her. And she's 14, 15 years old, and 16 or whatever, and it's not too late. It's never too late, you know. If she could have somebody to talk to or just, I mean, you know, at that age, sometimes you don't want to just talk to people. You know what I'm saying? You don't want to talk to adults, like, whatever. They don't listen. They don't care. You know what I'm saying? But it's ways around it. I can't tell you the ways. Like I said, she's just that million-dollar question. But she can be saved. It's never too late.
My name is Megan McNeil. I'm the peer ambassador, co-coordinator with Tracy. This is my third time watching the film, too. And what kept sticking out to me over and over again is at the very end, when the prosecutor says, well, when do we stop trying to rehabilitate these children and lock them up? But throughout the film, where was her rehabilitation?
They didn't rehabilitate.
This girl has been through her. She had a drug addicted mother, so she was in the child welfare system. Her biological family has a history of psychiatric disorders. I did not hear where they even began to get any any kind of treatment. So, I mean, that question just bothered me over and over again. And as I look out on the youth in our community, there are so many youth that are suffering from, or not, shall I say suffering, but that find themselves in those same situations in their families and at school, and that aren't getting any services at all. And whether they are even geared right, the ones that are getting the services, are they, there's just so many youth that are in the cracks and not even following through. And so just that prosecutor statement just really bothered me that, you know, when do we give up? When did you guys even ever try? I mean, are we, and we're not even, and I'm saying we, because, I mean, I think it's charged all of us. Like, when are we even trying?
So. I can't help observing that at this very moment, a proposal is in the state legislature to cut drug treatment programs and drug education programs. And that is a fact that we are currently facing. You had something to add.
I'm Walt Blumenschein with Grow World Community Mental Health Movement. The fact that her mother or stepmother said that she didn't talk to her, or you don't have to talk, you got to listen. And that kid, you know, that kid was talking to her whole life, but she wasn't listening to her. That's the key to the communication, is we have to listen to them. You know, we can talk until we're blue in the face, like you say, but we've got to listen is more important. And I try to speak with my ears before I speak with my mouth. And I wish our politicians, and I wish our other activists in the community did the same thing, and we talk together and work together instead of working against each other the way we seem to do, because we're all trying to fight for that dollar that's getting stretched out so thin. That's about all I got to say right now.
But and I would like to say, you know, it started with the foster parent. That could have been our help. That it could have started right there. That could have been her help. But she didn't. She was there physically. You know, she probably, you know, took care of her, bought her things, you know. And as she, since Toya said, she said, if I would try to tell her something, she'd be like, okay, girl, go play. You know what I'm saying? Not really being her mother emotionally. Like, she kept saying, where was I? Where was you? You know what I'm saying? You're right. Where was you at? You know what I'm saying? Like, if you know what I'm saying, if you was, like she said, she's very close to her mama. She's in jail now, and her foster mom comes to see her every other week. But where was you? You couldn't start. I mean, in between all of this dysfunctional stuff that happened with her family, her real family, you seemed like you were the best person. But how did she come from your wonderful family into living with a drug dealer? How did she even get there? How did she, you know what I'm saying? What happened? Where was you? I don't understand. And they could have started with her help right there.
And yet Centoya doesn't seem to blame her stepmom at all.
Yeah.
I think we have to be careful, though, that in looking at this documentary, of course, there's big pieces missing that we don't see.
Yeah.
What I see with foster parents is that a lot of times they're ill-equipped to deal with what they're given. We have to do a better job as a child welfare system of teaching and training foster parents how to deal with some of these different issues that the children we place in their home have. We also have to make sure that we put the supports in place, not only for the child, but for the foster parent, so that they can get the appropriate treatment, whether it's counseling, whether it's they need to be on a medication or a combination of counseling and medication, whether it's mentoring, tutoring, whatever they need. We need to make sure that we put those things in place to support that foster parent. The foster parent can give a roof over the head. They can give them food, clothing. You know, they can give them love. But some of these children, by the time they get into a foster parent's home, they have suffered so many different types of trauma, or have suffered trauma for such a long period of time, that it is not something that a foster parent can fix just by giving them love and food and shelter. It's going to take professional help and intervention. When kids suffer trauma, it affects their brain. It changes it forever. And this baby, she started being victimized in her mother's womb. When she started drinking, that alcohol affected the development of her brain. and that area of the brain that helps us all to reason, that was not developed fully in her because of the assault of the alcohol. We call it fetal alcohol syndrome. But so from birth, before she was even born, she was already put at a disadvantage. She was already being traumatized. Then she had physical abuse, sexual abuse, separation at the critical developmental stages when children are bonding with their parents and being moved around. So when you have that type of trauma, you can place them in the most loving, caring, giving, wonderful foster home you can find. And that may not be enough. It will not be enough. There has to be more put into place to support that foster parent in helping that child to heal. And well, that's a process.
I mean, which is correct, but which is, we know it's going to be a process. But as we can see, as Satoya said, you know what I'm saying, and the mother, the foster mother said, she had like a hold on me. If somebody was to get close to me, she would get upset. So as we can see that Satoya, you know what I'm saying, she trusted in her. Because every other place she had been in, she didn't feel accepted. You know, she didn't feel trustworthy. So we can see that she kind of trusted in the foster parent. And we know, you know, the foster parent couldn't fix it because it's been years of abuse and all that. But it seemed like, as Satoya said, the first part of it was she didn't even stop to listen.
Do we have another?
So she could even tell the DCFS or whatever workers what needed to be done, you know. Satoya told me this needs to happen.
I'm really dittoing what the panel has said, but I worked for many years in adoption, and with adoption, there really is a sense that, well, the child is adopted, we can close the books, we can go on our way, and they're fine now. And as this mother stated, really, foster parents are in a better position than adoptive parents because they're still connected with services. Adoptive parents are not, unless things are really to the point of a crisis, where in this situation where it's too late. I didn't see any discussion about this child or the family having mental health services. I didn't see anything about the kids, her having school services, medical care, or any of that. But there's this assumption that, see, there's this wonderful outcome. There's an adoption that took place. This child has a brand new life, and that's the end of it. And we see that a lot in bringing it here to this community, where adoptive parents don't know where they can go. They don't have access to the same services. But yet they're held to the same standard as a parent who has given birth to a child that didn't have all of this trauma. So many times they're criticized because they're not able to parent this child or do things in the right way for a child who's had all of this trauma, and they don't know where to turn. So really, as a community, I say that that's one area that we cannot ignore, because we have a lot of parents who have reached out and put themselves on the line to adopt children who've had difficult paths, and then when something goes awry, we want to say, well, why didn't you do this better, or why didn't you do that better? And what we need to say is, how can we be there in support of these families?
There's a question up here.
Another question over here?
Good evening. My name is Chike Coleman. I host Real Reviews for UPTV. I just want to state something. The first question anyone ever, when someone tells me something is wrong, there's something wrong in my life, I just ask them, what do you want to say? And then I wait. And I wait for a very, very, very long time until the conversation stops. This can be over the phone, over instant messaging, or even over an email. I just ask them, what do you want to say? Once they tell me what they want to say, that is when I start asking myself, okay, I'm not in their shoes, I'm not in their socioeconomic situation, I'm not even in the next room with them, but I need to know how this is affecting them. What's hurting them, how can I make it better? And sometimes we don't really have all the answers. I'm 24 years old, and I've never been in the type of situations that our main protagonist has been in tonight. But I always ask with, what do you need to say? Tell me what you need to say. And as soon as I learn that story, then I can ask questions as to what does this mean to you? What does that mean to you? How are you affected by it? And if they don't know, I just say take it one word at a time. That, I believe, is how we can change this problem with our youth. That's all I have to say.
Thank you.
Hi. My name's Rob, and I'll start by saying I was really glad to see this movie, and I'm glad I saw it. I work with a lot of guys in a prison, formerly with Tracy, too, in a correctional center in Danville. And I know that on balance, the majority of those guys have been in there since they were 16, 17, 18. So devastating to watch from the other end of the pipe headed into the prisons. So glad that the film is made and showing an image of this. I'm curious if anyone has anything that we might add in terms of being a little bit critically aware of the presentation of explanations in the documentary. I heard the genetic analysis presented maybe a dozen times, and I don't think the word poverty came up once. I didn't hear any mention of sexism in the entire thing, and we know that there were two parents. There was a father we never saw. There were rapist men throughout the entire thing. And then there's also a prison system on the other side of this that organizes sexual violence and violence itself. So I guess I wonder, is there anything to be added into this discussion about the other interlocking systems that are at work in Zentoya's life?
That's actually what I was sitting here thinking about, was the institutional racism that you see is, although she was adopted by a family, it seemed to be a two-parent home, were there services that were even provided to this young lady? Was there services that were even, were there even the things that she even began to become involved with? Did they even see or someone even try to reach out, or did they just see her as another kid who is just not listening or just defiant, and this is where she deserves to be? And so those are one of the things that did ring out for me, was the racism that you see of just even not even looking at the alternatives that could have taken place. Many things could have happened. But in particular for this child, those things weren't even looked at or considered. And even the interview with the psychiatrist, that also really rang true to me. There were a lot of different biases and prejudices that came through, even through his interview as well.
I'd like to touch on just a little bit about the prison system and just the court system in general. We know that typically for minority children and adolescents, the legal system treats them differently. We see it in our own community. Oftentimes you can take two adolescents the same age, same gender, but all you change may be same socioeconomic status, and all you have to do is change the skin color. And that white 15-year-old boy who goes out and, let's just say, he vandalizes something, he goes into the court system, and then you have the African-American 15-year-old boy who goes out and does something about of the same equal nature. The Caucasian child may end up in a diversion program. We're going to have you do the victim offender reconciliation program. Write an apology letter, pay a court fine, do a little community service. We're going to wipe this off your record. It never happened. But you take that African-American youth who's 15-year-old who did something similar, and more than likely he's going to go to court. More than likely he's going to be convicted. More than likely he may get some of the same similar punishment, because minority children are usually punished. And non-minority children are usually rehabilitated or deflected. And so we know that there are those types of things out there that happen. If they weren't there, we wouldn't have a disproportionate number of minority youth, in particular African-American youth, in higher numbers in the juvenile justice system, in higher numbers in the child welfare system. And so that we see happen on a daily basis. I feel like if the first thing I thought when I saw the driver's license and saw that the guy she killed was white, I was like, oh, it's all over for her. That was my reaction. I knew from the soon as I saw his license, she got convicted and she got life. You know, because the value that's placed on life in this country is dependent on the color of your skin. So we have to face that. We have to recognize that. And in whatever, you know, your locus of control or influence is, if you're a frontline worker, whatever you can do to try to make a difference, you do that. If you're a policymaker, whatever you can do to try to make a difference, you do that. If you're somebody in the community, you know, whether it's writing letters to, you know, whoever, if it's going into the system and trying to work within the system, we all have different ways that we can impact and make a difference and try to combat some of that institutional racism that we see that we deal with on a regular basis, because it is there. The poverty, that influences what's going to happen. The mental health, if it's not addressed, that's going to influence what's going to happen. There's just so many other factors that go into what led to her situation.
Hi. First, I would like to commend this panel for coming out, especially Shalonda for coming out, just speaking about her past and what she's endured and how she resembles Shatoni. I am Satoya. I am I'm a foster parent who's raised multiple girls that resemble the situation that that young lady has done. I'm also a service provider. And my question is, where do we go from here? We are losing too much time talking about it and not doing anything about it. We don't have to sit around the table to save these children. We can do it one person at a time, advocating for these children in the neighborhood, in our school buildings, in our churches. We don't have to have a degree to do this. If you have it in your heart and you have it as a desire, you can do it to save these kids. I'm a thorn in almost everybody's side, I know, because I'm an advocate for these kids. I see it, I live it, I did it before, so I don't want to be a backseat driver. I want to be the one that's standing up front, saving these children, and I don't do it for the money. A lot of us won't come to the table unless there's a dollar price attached to it. Don't make this a 9-to-5, because these children is living this 24/7. I've buried a foster child, and I've also gave one away as the mother of a bride, and I've celebrated the graduation of one that got her master's degree. So you have to, one person at a time can make a change in a child's life. Stop talking about it, and let's put a plan together for our children to make a difference in their lives so they can one day look back and not be looking at us from prison walls.
I can't top that.
All right, I'll take the mic. I just want to recommend everybody. No, I don't. I'm not even supposed to be here. I'm here under duress. Everybody needs to get this book, The New Jim Crow. And if we have nerve as a community, we need to invite Michelle Alexander to come to this community. And that, I'm going to just say that and leave everybody with homework. Michelle Alexander, The New Jim Crow. If you really want to agitate, bring her down with her pastor, Reverend Otis Moss III and Jeremiah Wright. We need to get on the front page of the News Gazette about what's happening to our children and agitate. You know, my favorite word is agitate. That movie didn't need to be done wherever it was done. It should have been named Greg Moore. That's all I need to say. It should have been named Greg Moore. And that should be enough for us to understand our own plight in this community and what happens to black children. So, Michelle Anderson, I think some people in here got some training money. that they need to spend, and I can give you her phone number, her email, and drive you to Chicago and meet her.
Other thoughts? Go ahead.
Yeah. I just had a question about the way this film is being released. My understanding is that it's being released sort of all across the country, just like this, where it's being shown in public libraries or other public spaces where people are then having discussions. Is that accurate? Do you all know?
Yes.
Okay. So I was just wondering, is there a way, I mean, in terms of thinking about going forward, is there a way to sort of collect statements? I mean, I know it's being recorded, but I mean, what kind of statements can we make in this local space, which can then be put in dialogue all across the country and, you know, with the possibility of making actual real institutional changes happen?
That is a really interesting idea. And I don't specifically know if Independent Lens is facilitating that kind of thing. I know that's the kind of thing they would like to do, but...
They are. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, on their website, they actually have different thoughts and...
It's a blog?
It's a blog that they actually have as well, too.
Yeah.
And it's on their website, and they also have, like, discussion guides and Facebook. They got lots of different things that they have.
You can go to the WILL website and find information about connecting with the different communities throughout the United States that are having community cinemas like this. And after this discussion, there are some some surveys that you can fill out, and that information also gets sent back to the Independent Lens. So they're coordinating these types of conversations to try to get the communities to do things. That's their goal.
And to kind of even piggyback on Henry, what he's saying, the Access Initiative also has handouts in the back as well that talks about resources and ways you can get involved here locally. We also have some handouts on risk factors and different things that you can identify and ways that you can look at, maybe ways you can even point somebody to that right direction, because this is a community effort.
And also, if you are in contact or have a relationship with any youth that you may want to refer to some positive programs in the community, we have peer ambassadors, and we have an open house coming up next Thursday. There is the Youth Advisory Board. It's another positive opportunity for students. So there are some supports in this community. And I just encourage you to leave here and do something. Regina said it. You know, it doesn't take an education. It doesn't take money. It just takes some time and some passion and some concern for what we do and how we do to support our kids. I also want to put out a plug. There's another positive program, Motivating Work Males, in this community. There's so many things that we can do if we just come together and just carve out an hour of your time a week. I mean, what's an hour? An hour of your time a week could really make a difference in the life of one child. And I can hook you up with some kids today if you want to. Just holler at me after the program.
I'm Lindsay with the Peer Ambassadors. And I've seen this movie twice, and I think it would make more of an impact instead of just showing it, like, with groups like this, but, like, showing it also in the schools, because, like, not every kid, you know, is in a group like this or with peer ambassadors or any other group, so they can't see it. But I think that it would make more of an impact if we showed it in the school, so then kids would get, like, a feeling, you know, that they're not alone, like, other people are going through the same thing.
This is going to be broadcast Tuesday night at 9 p.m.
My name is Jerry with the Peer Ambassadors. One thing I kept hearing was rehabilitation, and I'm a living story of it myself. I'm from Chicago, and I've been through a lot of stuff, but never got caught up in the systems. But like through rehabilitation with the right people, I was able to reach out to youth who was going through similar things to me, and they opened up to me. And when they opened up to me, you know, I was able to give them resources to get help the way I got help. So once we do the rehabilitation of youth, it'll just be like a chain reaction. And instead of our adults helping the youth, our youth can also help the youth. So
I started there when I was 13. And just like you, very slowly, you know, time by time. I wasn't trying to. I was still going back and forth to JDC and still doing this. But slowly but surely, it helps. It does.
My name is Sean Lampkins. I'm from the Youth Advisory Board Access Initiative. And I want to commend Jerry on his comment and sort of speak to this question this gentleman asked about systems and the different types of systems that are involved. It does take a community. All these issues reside within us individually, and we can make a pledge to try to resolve them individually. But having a system and various systems that really do have an ear for and a desire to listen to the youth and the families whom these systems purport to serve is imperative to making changes. And as we see in the case of Egypt, as we've seen in the case of Tunisia, France, and history, the civil rights movement, it was actually the youth themselves. Out in the street, Martin Luther King was 26 years old when he began. So if we allow the youth and the families to have say in what it is that they want and in what it is that they want to do, they themselves, as long as the system support it, can make the changes in their lives that are necessary for them to move forward and live a productive, happy, healthy life that we all want to lead. So I would encourage all of us to be passionate and to go out and find those youths, but to also push our systems to put those institutions, mechanisms in place so that those systems who really want to serve these youth and these families really are listening to these youths and these families.
So I'm hearing that it's both personal and institutional. I'll wait to ask that. Go ahead.
In addition to some of the everyday things we can do, just being able to grab one of our neighbors, children who need some help next door or across the street, there is a group called Saving Our Families Together Today, and it is a group designed to change those systems. It's a community action group that meets here at the library every third Wednesday, March 16th, and it is a group of concerned citizens, parents, professionals that put their heads together about ways we can make change. So here's some brochures. Heidi Gulbranson is the facilitator.
Brochures are here. So one concrete thing you can do. Jonte Rollins is the other co-facilitator from Project Access. So we're trying to work together so that we're not overwhelming people, but we really want to deal with Soft Start is dealing with the child welfare system and the issues of disproportionality, and then joining with Access. So we just really want to make change. We do have lots of those around the table meetings, but we also really want to do things. If that's going out and hitting neighborhoods and starting to talk to people, that's what we want to do. We want to do new things. DCFS is sharing statistics that we've never shared before. You can talk to me afterwards or email me or call me off the brochure, and you can get on the mailing list and find out what's going on in child welfare.
I want to piggyback on that because he mentioned the Youth Advisory Board, and actually the Department of Children and Family Services has a Youth Advisory Board for children who are involved in the foster care system. And they do get together and actually get input from those children about how the system has impacted them and what the system can do different and better. And there have been changes made in child welfare because of the input of those children and adolescents that have participated not only in the Youth Advisory Board, but they've also worked closely with the University of Illinois Children and Family Research Center and actually gave the children money to come and talk with them about their experiences, what could have been done differently, better, more of, less of, and use that information to make some changes in the child welfare system. So anybody that knows a teenager that's involved in the foster care system, that is a way for their voice to be heard is through the Youth Advisory Board at DCFS.
Jack, I know you want to get to your question, but what I wanted to share with the audience as I hear a number of great ideas and suggestions. You're hearing a lot about the Access Initiative, and I think that's important that as a community we begin to talk about system change and engagement. And so we've heard that we have a lot of programs and services in our community. We've heard that we've got great individuals doing great work. What we don't have is the connectivity of all of this. And so the exciting part about what we're doing at the Access Initiative is building our capacity as a community to handle and connect to this work systemically and structurally. And so what's happened is, you know, these things have happened in pockets. And so that's why the kids are in the cracks or falling in the cracks or falling. They're underneath the cracks and the information and everything is falling on top of them. So whatever the scenario may be, we're going to create the avenues and the vehicles for us to have conversation and to do work because they both have to happen simultaneously. And so we haven't talked enough. When we have these kind of forums, it's the, was it preaching to the choir, or it's the same group of folks that are here. So what we have to do is take our conversation broader. So whether it's with policymakers, whether it's with youth, whether it's with systems providers, we have to create avenues and vehicles for us to have these conversations to really connect it. And so you'll hear a lot about access, and we're pleased to be part of this conversation tonight. And we have many youth in our community that fall into this scenario. So we see these national issues, these national kids, youth, but they really are here locally. And it will take a collective effort of not only of us in this room, but those folks that we know we need to engage to this work. So we're pleased to be partners in this discussion and use this as a catalyst for new and more conversation and discussion and debate.
And work. So I'll quickly ask this question. You're talking about, personal intervention, things we can do as people. There's also institutional issues that we have. One of those institutions is the media. How is it doing at addressing these issues? How is it doing at addressing institutional racism, the problems of our kids, the lack of support or the cracks are falling into? What do you all think? Any thoughts about that? And what should the media be doing? What is the responsibility of the media in this?
I would like to start that off because I'm one of those people that that go around and try to help people become more culturally aware. And I think one of the biggest enemies, and God forgive me, and media forgive me, is the media. Whether it's newspapers, books, magazines, the nightly news, the radio, stereotypes and the myths surrounding not only minorities but minority youth are perpetuated by the media in many instances. And I think, I like to listen to NPR radio. I like to watch, WILL and PBS. But most of the media, it perpetuates the stereotypes. It perpetuates the myths. Every now and then a rare jewel occurs and you'll see something on TV or hear something on the radio or see something in the newspaper that is meaningful and useful and helps to bridge gaps instead of create further divides. The media has a long way to go. And I think that You know, we need to do more writing letters to the editor. We need to do more. It saddens me because, you know, I have two sons, 10 and 17, and I get so tired of seeing the stereotypes perpetuated on the nightly news about kids that look like my sons, and to try and teach them self-worth and their importance in this world. You're constantly, as a parent, as an educator, as a community activist, trying to combat those negative images that tell our teens that they're not worthy, that they're not worthy, that they don't have anything to contribute, that they're not important. It's hard work. It's a daily battle. And so, you know, the media needs to come to the table. They have a lot to learn, and they have a lot they need to unlearn. That's just how I feel. I'm just going to keep it real. The media has a long ways to go.
I think I can speak from the point of view of a young adult today with the media and the type of things that are being presented to us. It's crazy. It's nothing like it used to be. And I say it's from little things like we used to have the Cosby Show, which was a great show for families you could watch with your kids. We don't really have any kind of black shows like that that can help guide our youth. We have The Game, which is cussing and sexuality, all that kind of stuff, and you can't watch that with your kids. And it's just things today are so much more, they want to propel the negative images. I was in the NAACP AXO competition last summer, and there was a special on CNN about it. One special on CNN is not going to conquer all the different things that there is on BET or the different rap videos, just little things like that. I don't think we have enough to go against what is being built today.
Centoya's story would be quite a bit different on the nightly news.
Oh, yeah.
My name is Isaiah Williams. I'm with the Youth Advisory Board. And I don't know if this is going to make a difference, but, I was seeing, you know, how, people, a lot of teens been dropping out lately. Like, the rate is going up. And, I think, if you see something, you notice something wrong with a person, you should always say something. Like, especially, you know, like something was wrong with them before and they told you, you should especially say something then, and, you know, parents or, you know, guardians, you know, say something to your child. You feel something like is going wrong if they going out, you know, in them streets. And, it might change something in their mind. You might stop something.
Thank you. Not looking the other way, in other words. We're just about out of time. We have about 3 minutes left. Time for another question, comment, et cetera. Any concluding thoughts from our panel?
I just wanted to say, as we're talking about the media, one of the things that we have in our community that we don't talk about that is something that's positive going on, there is an actual community portal called eBlackCU. On this portal, it's ways that the community can download all kind of pictures, articles, images, different things that we have done in our community. And the challenge is no one is really utilizing that. The internet is a very powerful thing. Yeah, it is a part of the media, and there are some things on there that have been used for bad, but I think that that's also an aspect that we could even build off on. It's worldwide, and you can get it everywhere. The challenging thing is more people overseas use it more than we do here, and it was created here. So I think that we can look at that and begin to put positive images on the actual internet, and that can spread even wider.
Well, we're just about out of time. Did you have a blessing?
I just want to end tonight with the note of inspiration. Centoria is pursuing an associate's degree at the David Liskum University as part of a college in prison program. So just the fact that she's facing life, she's still empowered to make a difference in her own life. And that's what we need to instill in our youth, that regardless of what you do, regardless of whatever mistakes you can make, you can't count them out. You know, they can really make a difference in their life.
And it's never, ever, ever, ever too late. Never. Never. It's never too late.
Great note to end on. I want to thank our panel, Tracy Days, Sherlonda Sales, peer ambassadors, Carol Bradford, Lutheran Social Services, and, of course, Chandra Somerville, Access Initiative. And thank you all for being here.
We have some surveys that can give your input about this evening, and we can get that back to ITV. The next one is the 17th of March. It's a Thursday. Please fill out one of the questionnaires. Thank you all for coming. And remind people that didn't see this, this will be on television Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on WILL Television. Thank you all again for coming out.